Your gas mileage decreases rapidly once you get above 60 miles an hour. You have the power to make a difference. By taking these steps, you can save money and help our nation reduce its energy use.
For more tips on saving money at the gas pump, please visit our website at www.energy.gov or call toll-free 1-877-337-3463. This powerful savings message is provided by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Alliance to Save Energy.
And it's 3 minutes after 6 o'clock. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. Time for Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Golsfina with you on this lovely Tuesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yeah, I am Kyle, and I'm here. Welcome. and welcome back from an exciting weekend.
Yeah, it was exciting.
Is this officially intersession?
Oh, yeah.
It's intersession.
You know what? I don't know if summer classes have begun yet. Maybe.
They redid all the curbs on campus, I noticed. A lot of...
Why is that the priority?
I don't know. There were sections that I guess had been destroyed, perhaps by snowplows or other heavy equipment. They're also digging up all the steam pipes in the middle of the...
I noticed that.
The road and some of the
big
green
steam
space.
Pipe just lying on the ground for anyone to take.
It's amazing.
No security.
Yeah. They just basically balance them, and they're, I guess, presuming that no animals are going to, you know, take up refuge, or people, as you said, would hitch them to their truck.
If you have a backhoe and the right kind of truck, you could definitely make a killing.
It's a lot of iron.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like just scrap metal.
And, you know, you joke about animals living in there, but what would be so bad about people living inside one of those huge pipes? You'd be protected from the rain.
Mm-hmm.
And the wind,
yeah.
And there's no sewage coming down, or you know, it's not plugged into anything. But I just think, you know, kind of a post-apocalyptic war, that would be the abode of choice. That's just what I'm thinking.
Well, yeah, it's good to keep your options open, definitely.
Could have a little, like, kind of entryway with, like, a tent or something, or just a piece of fabric.
I was thinking, like, the beaded...
Beads. Beads are good. You hear people when they're coming in.
Yeah.
You have a nice long corridor. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, the whole thing is just a nice long corridor.
Yeah.
But that's okay. You know, I have friends who their life's ambition was to live on a bus, so this is not that bad.
It's good to have ambitions.
Well, you know, you find one of those old industrial parks or housing developments that people lost interest in that still have the massive pipes lying on the ground.
Yeah.
You could make this work. You could make this work. HGTV, we got to call them. This is a good miniseries, I think. You know, where they build up a nice house for somebody? How about a nice big pipe for people to live in?
Yeah. I mean... We met in a missile silo.
We did.
That's almost about a month.
Under tense circumstances. And actually, it was 10 years ago already.
Oh, already? Okay.
I realized that with dismay that I missed it because it was July 4th. It was July 4th.
Okay, all right.
In
2009
at the tour camp, the first ever tour camp.
In Odessa, Washington.
Yes.
10 years ago.
Missile silo. An abandoned missile silo. That's where you have a hacker conference.
That was some stuff.
Yeah, it sure was.
That was some stuff. Serious business out there.
Memories.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, as you say, there are things outside. I noticed what I'm concerned about are the trees, that somebody's idea was to plant new trees here, but not to actually put them in the ground. So they're just kind of sitting there waiting for somebody else to put them in the ground. It's like a big hint. Like, here's the tree. It's still in the bag. And here's some earth. But I'm not going to put it in the ground. Someone else has to do that. And I'm just worried because they're kind of wilting a little bit. I don't think anyone's watering them. So you have all these trees kind of hanging around. And is somebody going to plant them in time, or are we just going to have a bunch of dead trees?
I think there's a plan. I think that they basically place them so that there's a crew of people with the right kind of tools to dig nice nice spots. Well, the spots have been chosen, but they just have to dig them out.
They have to dig them. That's all they have to do.
Plunk them into the hole and douse them with a bunch of water. And
but where's this team? Maybe they're digging holes on another campus.
Maybe they're on another part of campus.
All right. Well, this is us sending out a mayday for the trees to please plant us, you know, water us, because we're trees and... Yeah, we need trees.
Yeah, they could be subject to abuse if they're above ground like that much longer. So do expedite that,
uh-huh.
Stony Brook grounds folks. What would you call them?
Maintenance? Garden crew? I don't know. I should know this. We all should know.
Wouldn't it be like...
Who maintains the trees
on
Stony Brook campus?
I'm
going to
say facilities. Grounds and facilities.
What kind of people are we?
I see they have like...
Facility sounds right, but it's not really a tree. It's not really a facility.
It grounds.
For a squirrel, it's a facility, but not for us.
Groundskeeper Willie?
Grounds. Please. Now you're just making a mockery of the whole thing, Groundskeeper Willie. As if he has any interest in this.
Groundskeeper Wolfie.
That's good. That's really good. Because Wolfie, you know, because the sports team.
I'll be here.
Whatever.
All hour.
All right. In all seriousness, it was the 4th of July. We took a trip. We went out to Greenport.
That was something.
We took the train to Greenport. Have you ever done that? There is a train that goes to Greenport. Yeah. You don't see it very often. I think there's like two a day. And it's very tiny. It's only two cars, not counting the engine. Two cars. And guess what? The platforms only hold one car. I don't know whose idea that was. So if you're in the... Well, it's easier when they tell you, if you're not in the front car, you got to move up. You know, when the train is like 15 cars long, you don't know what car you're in. But when there's only two, it's easy to know if you're in the front or the back. So they had to make those announcements. But, you know, we saw stations like Medford and Yaphank and Southold, you know, places like that that were pretty pretty. I didn't know they had. I didn't know they had stations. For the life of me, I thought Cutshog had a station. They did have a station, but it closed in the early 60s, so there's no way I would know that station was actually there. And there were a bunch of others, too. But it's a rather slow line. It's all diesel, and it goes out to Greenport. We literally went out to Greenport to get a cup of coffee and come back because we only had an hour before the train returned. And if we missed that train, we would have been there another 5 hours or maybe overnight. It's the 4th of July, you know, Greenport's a nice place, but I don't know how much time we really wanted to spend out there.
It was a great reason. I mean, they have a good local roaster there and some public spaces. People were basically getting ready for the evening's festivities, and it was a nice, sunny, warm afternoon. We're basically doing our thing whilst the big Salute to America was going on in D.C., which apparently got rained out. We got all the 4th of July weather, and it just poured and was cloudy, and teleprompters were breaking. It was just this whole mess. Yeah, but we had it nice. It was great.
The defensive celebration of America in D.C. that took place. That was sad. The whole thing with the tanks and Trump turning it into a rally. No, he gave a speech that wasn't as bad as people were afraid, but... The way the whole thing was presented, it was a. If you watch it on C-SPAN, the whole thing is on C-SPAN. You will see the people there with Trump hats. You won't see anybody with anything else because they weren't allowed in. That's wrong. That's not what America is all about. America is diversity. America is an amazing mix of people from all different places. We went to a wedding over the weekend that. Was mostly Indian and in Queens, and it was amazing all the diversity that you see just in Queens in general. But to see all these people celebrating together in so many different cultures—that's what America is, and that's not what you saw at that particular, at least not what was being presented to the world. So if the world is watching, that's not us. That's part of us. That's one element. That's the defensive element. But this country is so much more than that. And I just hope we realize it before it's too late.
Yeah, it's worth preserving. It's worth trying to get right. As crazy and far gone as it seems, we're still at it here in the U.S. And boy, you noticed, and I think this is a really good observation just about that whole thing and what we're making these holidays. I heard a soundbite that Trump wanted to make this like a regular thing now. And start this tradition, and I think it was a good point that Veterans Day, Memorial Day, and now 4th of July are military holidays.
Yeah, when did 4th of July become a military holiday? You know, it was about blowing things up. Just citizens blowing civilians blowing things up, and
generic patriotism, stars and stripes. You know, the spirit, the common goals, and just a recognition of our nation's independence and everything in between to whatever end as having been a part of that project.
I didn't get independence out of the things he said. I got dominance out of the things he said. We can kick anyone's ass. You know, all these he's going through all the wars, literally going through all the wars we've been involved in. I don't know if he spent time on Grenada, but I'm sure he covered it at some point. That's not what we should be celebrating on the 4th of July. We should be celebrating independence, individual thought, diversity, all the things that potentially make us great.
Yeah.
I say potentially because we seem to be trying to quell that, the best elements of our nation. And the 4th of July is just, you know, as someone who feels independent most of the time, that's what we should be celebrating. Independence on a collective level, independence on an individual level.
Yeah, I think what happens is it creeps away from the ethos, the things that those individuals were fighting for as being the thing to celebrate, and into those who have died in war are why we fight. And that's not really it. That's totally it obscures the actual reasons. Like the individuals who were fighting for independence, the things that they were passionate about, and those things are why we recognize those events. Maybe Veterans Day is more specifically about people who gave their lives.
Absolutely.
But even those individuals.
Actually, Memorial Day is for those who gave their lives. Sure. Veterans Day are for the ones who are still around.
Who are still around or were lost, or all of them in general. Mm-hmm. But Independence Day is about, I think, you know, what it means to be American. And I guess my point is specifically those wars were not why we fight. And in a lot of the cases, they're regrettable incidents of having fought, but they were not the goal or the ideal. And when you go through and chain different wars together and create an assumption that that's why we fight because of other wars, we fight because people died. No, I mean, those individuals died so that we can have our independence or continue to perfect this nation, but we're not fighting just to defend the honor of individuals who have fought before, and I think mm-hmm. it just conflates it really badly if you're not careful.
Yeah, and every time there is some kind of a military escapade, it's not something that we should be proud of. It represents failure to work things out, to act like civilized people. It should be considered the last recourse, and it should be something that we never want to send our best people out to be killed and maimed. That is a horrible thing to do, and especially the way they're treated when they get back, which, you know, is basically like crap. And it happens time and time and time again. And we never seem to learn. And we just see the same things repeating themselves. We're seeing it in the Middle East yet again. With this whole Iran situation and people who are pushing for war, it's really ridiculous to be celebrating all these military triumphs and not having learned the lessons that can keep us from getting involved in more of them. I guess, you know, they just look about it. They look at it as like football games or things that they can win and be victorious and notch up another victory, but you're killing lots and lots of people. You're destroying lots and lots of lives. And we're not getting a very good reputation in the world. We're not getting a very good reputation at home. You know, there were people at the 4th of July event in D.C. Who were burning the American flag. And, of course, everybody focused on them. It's only a handful of people. But still, they got all the media attention. Donald Trump Jr. You got to follow this Twitter account if you really want a work of art. Donald Trump Jr. Sometimes he's far worse than his dad. Was tweeting that they were a bunch of commies. When's the last time you heard the word commie? Yeah, that's where we are. We're going back to like the 1960s. A bunch of commies burning the American flag. These people burning the American flag probably have more of a sense of patriotism than anyone in power does now, because burning the American flag is free speech. And doing that is a celebration of that free speech. Now, beyond that, okay, probably the conversation would devolve, but that act, that is something that is protected. It's something that those who want to control everything never seem to understand, never seem to appreciate. Doesn't matter that it's protected by the Constitution. Doesn't matter if the Supreme Court weighs in. No, they want us to not have that freedom, along with many other freedoms they don't want us to have. But that is something that this country stands for. That's something that this country should protect. And to simply condemn these people and view them as the enemy is so simplistic and so wrong. And that's probably the best lesson I learned from 4th of July is how backwards we are in some ways. But so many good people, too.
For that reason, subdued for me. I mean, definitely I was listening to the celebrations and reflecting, I guess. But it's – yeah. It the – potential to overstep, and the way we define success is, you know, winning a war or being victorious, I think is highly subjective when you really get down to it. And if you're not careful, you know, what happens if you stumble into or have this attitude of dominance when, and for all intents and purposes, your actions are actually walking away from the alliances that are really protecting us, with regard to other nations and so on. Going it alone in that is, I think, a way to really increase the potential for missteps. And, you know, what happens if we do lose? Because I guarantee a lot of those wars and, you know, a lot of incidences that have been turned into rationales for fighting and dominance, such as has been, as we're remarking about, it's a place that you're defining for yourself. But I think you'd argue with that those veterans' families and the individuals lost as a result of terrorist attacks that were probably influenced by our dominance, that, you know, in another conversation is being celebrated. I think those people would argue that those are losses. It's even going back to Vietnam and the Korean War, but yet we're going to talk about that as our evidence of our victoriousness. I think it's just really foolhardy because, you know, when something comes up in the future and people are characterizing it as a victory, when you have, you know, hundreds or thousands of individuals at stake or lost or innocent people, as in Iraq, I mean, or thousands of soldiers coming back with PTSD or killing themselves or worse. I mean, are those really successes? Are those victories?
Well, yeah, of course not. No.
You know, but yet we're told or we are in conditioned to think and through repetition consider those losses our victory. I just think that is such a twisted and as I said, foolhardy way of
we have failed all the people we've sent over in the latest military escapade. I mean, is the region any better? No, the region's far worse. It's destabilized. It's, you know, all because of the lies that were spread by Bush back in the early part of the century, and the many hundreds of thousands of people who lost their lives over there. This is nothing to be proud of. We should not be celebrating that. That is not what makes America great. That is one of our afflictions, that we feel this is our duty, this is our role in the world community. And I just wish the rest of the world would stand up to us more. They don't do that enough, and that's why these things keep happening. Well, obviously because we do it, it keeps happening, but also we don't get challenged enough. That's, you know, Trump says all these ridiculous things, does all insane acts of I don't know what. I don't even know how to describe them.
Spite.
And look, the Iran deal is one thing that really, really has me upset over the last months, years. You know, we had a deal. Iran was living up to the deal. And now Iran is saying, you know what, why? The United States broke the deal. Although, if you read the media, it's never quite phrased that way. It's always the United States left the deal. Meanwhile, this week, everyone's talking about how Iran is breaching the terms of the deal, which no longer exists. Yeah, there's a deal with the remaining countries, but those remaining countries are so timid about it. They're jumping through hoops to avoid our sanctions because if they trade with Iran in certain ways, we're going to penalize them, even though they're doing exactly what they were supposed to do under the terms of the deal. They're not doing anything against us. We should be the ones that are the recipients of sanctions from all those countries that we signed the deal with, that we broke the deal. And now Iran is being accused of breaching the terms because they're doing the only thing that's that makes sense. They're being penalized, yet they are abiding by the terms. Why? Why would anybody continue doing that? They are 100% in the right, and I'm no fan. I don't want them to be developing nuclear weapons or even nuclear power, but they're pushed into a corner. So what do you expect them to do? We had a deal. We had a good deal, and it was working. And now we don't. So this is what happens. And
We saw something interesting that was relevant to this in the newsreel we were watching.
That's right, yes.
I don't know if that ties in.
To do that, we have to go into our feature. Okay, we have to go into our movie feature with our new theme that we, I think, paid too much for. But 1951, I believe, is the year that we just saw.
That's right.
An American in Paris was the American film that won the Oscar for that year. We already talked about the Japanese film that won the foreign, Rashomon, was it? Something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We talked about that last week. But this is American Paris, Gershwin songs, musical, all that kind of thing. Yeah, it was great fun. But we did see a newsreel, and that newsreel was talking about the crisis between Iran and England.
Yes.
Concerning oil. Here's the thing. Iran felt they should have control over the oil fields in their country. England disagreed. The United States disagreed. Even the Shah of Iran, who we basically installed, was already in power. He was taking the sides of his people. Imagine that.
Empathetic to the indigenous population.
But there was also a prime minister who was even more gung-ho for nationalizing. We basically told the Shah, you know what, we're going to take care of this with you or without you. And a couple of years later, we did. We initiated a coup. The Shah was already in power, but we still had a coup to put in a new prime minister and imprison the other one for the rest of his life and take over their oil. That's what we did. That's what we do. And it was a real lesson in history.
Yeah, and I think it's not to be discounted, the influence those actions and those perspectives on history have, and that should be thought of today. And I really hope that a lot of the foreign policy experts and national security and advisors, I don't want to get my hopes up too much, but I have very low expectations generally, but I really think that, we need to consider the perspective of the individuals that what they've experienced in the past. I think this goes for North Korea and a lot of other stuff. We have a very big problem with collective memory and our history tends to be inconsiderate of the people that we affect and have interacted with and dominated. Seems to be the word of the evening.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was kind of interesting. And when you get into the Iran deal, it, as you said, it is spiteful because of a political disagreement here. But what are we going to gamble with? We're going to gamble with nuclear weapons proliferation worldwide in that region, a region that does not have a shortage of weaponry and nuclear capabilities. And all over a political spat that Trump wants to basically rebrand with a deal that he's not presenting, and that's the real criminality is that he has nothing in to replace it with.
No.
But he's dismantled something so dangerous.
And I think he would accept the deal that was in place if that was his deal.
Yeah,
he just doesn't like the fact that it was Obama's deal, and he doesn't want anything of Obama's to stick around. It's ridiculous, childishness, and we're seeing it again today. In fact, with Obamacare now yet again being challenged in court, this is what the Republicans did. Okay, they got rid of the individual mandate. Remember, they voted that out because they had. A majority, and what they're doing now is saying that, well, you know what, there's no individual mandate, that makes it unconstitutional, so you have to throw the whole thing out. So they basically sabotaged it to the point where they can now make an argument saying that the whole thing is not worthy of being in existence because it doesn't have this element that they took out. That is how the Republicans work, and I wish the Democrats were this crafty. They're not. They're so wishy-washy and timid, and they need to really stand up and fight back. That is, I've been saying this for years. A lot of people have been saying this for years, but they never seem to do this. Hopefully, this will withstand this particular challenge because so many people's health care is at stake. We won't know for months. The arguments will go on, and the courts will rule, and it might go all the way to the Supreme Court again. how long is this going to go on for? When are we actually going to get to a point where we can move forward and not have all these vandals trying to dismantle everything that gets accomplished? I don't know, but that's where we stand. Let's focus on the film, because we did go into our film feature. American in Paris. These are good Americans. They were musical people.
Gene Kelly
dancing and he was supposed to be a painter in the film.
Yes, he had stayed on. Okay, like this ties into militarization. I mean, he was basically a vet from the previous conflict. Of course, Reconstruction is occurring. This is post-World War II. And he fell in love with Paris coming away from the war and basically stayed on and made a life for himself in Paris.
That's right. He also fell in love with a girl in Paris. But here's where the thing gets kind of crazy. There's three people. There's the piano player. There's the painter, who's Gene Kelly, who also, you know, is a great dancer. And you'd think that, you know, this guy is struggling as a painter. But he's tap dancing all over the streets of Paris, and nobody seems to notice that particular skill. I don't know. Plot hole, as far as I'm concerned. So, okay, you got the piano guy, who can't seem to find success anywhere except when he's dreaming about playing in a concert hall where everybody in the concert hall has his face. That was kind of weird.
Yeah.
This film was in color, by the way, which is also
Technicolor.
It looked really nice. It was very well shot. It should get the award just for that. A lot of special effects. A lot of what do you call that? We have different shots in the same, four or five different pictures things.
Montage?
I don't know.
Pictures in pictures. A lot of effects that you would not really expect at that time. But they really, as you said, made great use of the color. They were really pushing it.
So you got the piano guy, you got the painter guy who also dances, and you got this other French singer type. And they all know each other.
He's a comedian.
He's a comedian?
Henry, what was his name?
Was he a comedian in the film?
Well, a performer, yeah. I mean, he had a show.
Yeah.
He had a variety show.
Sorts, yeah. And at the beginning, he's describing this girl or woman, basically every way he describes her is somehow misinterpreted, but it's also represented in dance, in visuals, and that's really creative and imaginative. Then Gene Kelly runs into this girl by complete accident in a restaurant and immediately falls in love with her, because that's what you do. You see somebody and you immediately fall in love with them and you pursue them like some real creep, and eventually you win them over. And that's how things worked in the 1950s. I should also point out there was this other woman who just out of nowhere decided that Gene Kelly was the second coming and she was going to finance him. She was rich and she also had her ulterior motives, but because she was a woman, it was inappropriate. She's pursuing him. He's pursuing the woman that the French guy also is, unbeknownst to him, engaged to. And the whole thing just kind of goes from there.
Basically a love triangle.
Pretty much a quadrangle.
Venn diagram of triangles, love triangles overlapping. I think
I like the street scenes, but you know, it was all filmed in Hollywood. None of it was filmed except for maybe a couple of establishing shots. It was all filmed in Hollywood. It looked
hard
really
to tell,
authentic.
Though. Yeah, from the first frames, it was beautiful to hear the language, and a whole section of it, he's speaking French, really sets the scene. There's maybe some later shots, especially with the flashbacks and some of the more dramatic stuff, that you realize this is more a musical or more like a set, as though you were in a theater. Mm-hmm. But they did a great job, just the integrating the sets, the costumes, setting sort of a natural street scene in all those different ways. And of course, the inside shots of these crazy places. I particularly love the scene that showed his studio. If anybody's lived in a studio apartment where you have a kitchen and everything all in one place, there's a great shot that basically is what he does when he's waking up. And it just shows how his bed goes up on a pulley, and his kitchen comes out in four pieces, and there's a sitting area. It's just this great thing, and everything he's doing is dance moves. So he's closing doors, opening cabinets. It's all with his body in this sort of graceful waking up routine to go from the bed to a breakfast and then on with his day. So there's just cool choreography and little details like that that I thought were just incredible and reminded me of having a studio, and I'm sure many other people would.
A lot of corny humor, things you have to realize. It's the 1950s. This is how people were. If you can accept that, you can enjoy the film. And I thought it was pretty good. The last 20 minutes, no words spoken, all dance.
Yeah,
that was pretty amazing. Now, there's a lot of simplicity here. He wins the girl in the end. But I don't know why he wins the girl in the end, because the French guy is so nice that he says, oh, you want her? Okay, you know what? I'm going to give up and just not be engaged to her anymore. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And also, there's all these unresolved plot points that drive me crazy. For instance, okay, what's going on with his paintings? He was on the verge of having a show. You kind of dropped that and never resolved it. Is there a sequel in the works? I'd like to know what happened. And what about the woman who was pursuing him? You know, she was kind of an interesting story. You just kind of dropped that like a lead balloon. So it could have – I don't want to say it should be longer because it's almost 2 hours as it is, but I just like to have plot points resolved and not leave them hanging or have them as devices to get to a certain point.
Yeah.
Just seemed a bit unsatisfactory, but more than made up for it with the musical numbers.
Do you remember any of the idioms in the dialogue? There were a lot of lines, I think, also that we recognize that I think people use to this day just over and over again. Well, that was also, we watched a cartoon. That kind of confused me. But there were a lot of famous lines, I know. It's not the same thing. The cartoon was different. But.
Yeah, it was a cartoon that came along with the DVD. That was interesting, from 1951.
It was all about slang.
I felt blue and the person turns blue. All these things that somebody who doesn't know English would not understand. And it just went on for 8 minutes.
Yeah, and really is entertaining in and of itself. But do you remember, I mean, I don't know anything particularly, but I know there are a lot of lines in that movie that that people would recognize and
are referenced. I've got rhythm.
Okay. Yeah.
Wonderful, marvelous. I don't know how to say that, but all these it's all Gershwin.
Yeah.
In fact, that was the deal. If a particular song was used, all the music in the film had to be Gershwin. So that was was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Some people say it hasn't aged well. Some people say there were better films. Probably, but that's what it was for 1951. We move on to 1952. I don't know if you're going to like the next one.
That's fine.
A lot of people don't like the next one, but we'll see. And that's going to do it for our film corner for this week. All right. That said, let's go back out to Greenport, because that's where we went on July 4th for an hour. I learned, and you can do a lot of learning simply by riding a train and having the Maps app open on your phone. You see all these, what do you call it, where the rail goes off in a different direction and you don't know what it's doing? Sidings?
Spurs.
Spurs, that's it. That's the word.
A siding is parallel and doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
A spur is like an off-ramp or a section of track that goes off in a different direction and connects, perhaps, or goes to sort of a dead end
near a warehouse or something. I found a spur that just kept going forever. It turned out it was affiliated with Grumman way back in the day, went on for like a mile north. And it was right by Calverton, and we discovered that Calverton still has its shelter just sitting there. The station has been used, I think, since the 1980s. But looking it up, I discovered that there was how many Long Islanders know this, especially people out east? Do you know about the Pickleworks wreck? Yeah, that was, the biggest wreck in Suffolk County. It happened in 1926. I'm going to read some excerpts from a terrific newspaper called Dan's Papers, which is printed out east. The summer of 1926, Calvin Coolidge is president. Al Smith is the governor of New York. Prohibition is celebrating its 7th year. Warner Brothers makes the first talking motion picture, which we probably saw. Flappers do the Charleston. I don't know what that means. Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig are leading the Yankees to another pennant. Charles Lindbergh is barnstorming in biplanes around the country, and there is, for the most part, peace in the world. For most of the 20th century, many people in New York City would finish their 9-to-5 jobs at the end of the week, board a Long Island Railroad train at Penn Station, and come out to the peaceful countryside of the eastern end of Long Island, where they had summer homes with their families. On one of these occasions, Friday the 13th in August of 1926, things did not go as planned. Didn't affect the middle-class customers. who could pay relatively small sums for tickets on coaches that went relatively slowly and made many stops along the way. Instead, it went badly for the rich, who wanted a luxury ride, the Friday afternoon Shelter Island Flyer. Yeah, that was the name of the train, Shelter Island Flyer. Went out to Greenport. It was the mate to the Cannonball luxury train that went out to the Hamptons. We've taken that train out to Montauk. Now,
The modern iteration of that, yeah.
Well, I don't know how modern it is, but yeah, it's basically... Well, check this out. These trains, with whistles blaring and smoke trailing behind at 70 or even 80 miles an hour, that's far faster than they go today, I'll tell you that. They came along at high speed and stopped only once about halfway at Manorville and Patchogue, respectively. The cost of a seat on these luxury trains was double the cost of a seat on the regular train. For 10 times the cost, you could be pampered on this luxury train in what were called parlor cars. Those are Victorian living rooms on wheels with velvet curtains framing the windows, mahogany paneling on the walls, and oriental rugs across the floor. White-coated porters could serve drinks from a bar or come by with cigars and newspapers to where you sat in comfortable easy chairs, enjoying the countryside as it zipped by. Yeah, those taking the Friday high-speed train. I can't believe we had a high-speed line in the past, almost 100 years ago, and we don't now. Those taking the Friday high-speed trains were not among those who had to stay at their work all day. At this level of executive privilege, they wind things up at 3 p.m., be on their way before rush hour. The Shelter Island Flyer, which, by the way, didn't go to Shelter Island. It went to Greenport, and you had to take the boat to Shelter Island like you do today. That particular flyer left the city at 4:10 p.m. The train to the Hamptons would be leaving immediately afterwards. Anyway, what happened was, and you can read the whole story at danspapers.com because it really is a great summation of all this. About 40 miles west of Manorville, alongside the tracks in the farming community of Calverton, just before Riverhead, there sat a large old wooden barn that had been converted into a pickle packing factory. A railroad spur off the main line ended there in a dead end. In one end of this factory came local cucumbers, barrels of salt, barrels of spices, empty bottles with metal lids, cardboard boxes, bottles of glue, and stacks of labels that read Golden's Pickles. The word Golden's in the curve of a pickle, so you'd know exactly what you were getting. This label matched a huge curving wooden sign in the shape of a pickle mounted over the barn doors. It was 4 feet wide and 12 feet long. Men worked long hours, 5 days a week at this factory. The salt and spice barrels were on platforms on the attic rafters with chutes sending their contents down to vats as needed. Below, empty bottles were labeled and then sent down a conveyor belt to be filled with salt, brine, and a dozen pickles each. This person really did their research. Then they were topped and boxed and brought out to be put on an arriving railroad car. Now, on this particular day, late that afternoon, the foreman, noting that thunder and lightning was starting up again, sent the men home for the day at 5 p.m. instead of 6. He then locked up and went home himself. None of them noticed as they left in their Model Ts and wagons and flivvers? What's a flivver?
I don't know.
No idea. Okay, well, maybe somebody can help us with that. Flivver, F-L-I-V-V-E-R. Okay, that a 4-foot-high metal lever, which one way would let the trains proceed straight, but the other way would result in a train coming down the siding to the factory, was missing a small cotter pin. This 3-inch pin was designed to lock the lever one way or another so it could not move back and forth. It was the job of the factory foreman to move it, but it was not his job to notice the cotter pin was missing. As they left, the workmen might have noticed that at that moment the lever was positioned to allow the train to head on through as it was supposed to. The Shelter Island Flyer flew past the Edwards Avenue crossing at 70 miles an hour. The two sweating firemen had each shoveled more than 6 tons of coal into the fireboxes of their respective engines. Yeah, there were two engines on this thing. And now the rains had started again. The first engine passed the lever without moving it, but in doing so, shook the lever to the other position. And as a result, the large camelback wrenched over onto the siding. The smaller engine in front fell on its side and blocked the camelback for an instant. Then the two engines uncoupled, and the camelback hit and climbed up over the first engine, went airborne, and came down to smash directly on top of the pickle works, bringing almost all of it down with it. Behind, the parlor car and the smoking car crashed into the engines and fell apart. Behind that, the baggage car came off the tracks but was not severely damaged, and behind that, the 5 coaches lurched to a halt but remained on the tracks. People fled in every direction. Two men in a pickup truck sitting on Edwards Avenue at the railroad crossing witnessed the smoke and fire of this terrible crash. As they ran to the scene, they met a man from the wreckage carrying a small child. Taking the child, they returned to their truck and raced off towards Southampton Hospital as fast as they could. Help was called. Within 20 minutes, police cars and ambulances were there. Also arriving was a contingent of soldiers from the nearby Army training base Camp Upton, the 62nd Coast Artillery Battalion. They arrived in a truck with floodlights on the roof. The only survivors among the five firemen and the engineers was engineer Charles Jackson, who was thrown through the open skylight of the Camelback into the air. He was found on the wooden floor of the part of the pickle works still standing, where rescue people arrived to see him fighting suffocation under an ever-increasing mountain of salt cascading down from the broken barrels in the attic rafters above. His mouth was held clear of it until he could be pulled out. Engineer William Squires and fireman John Montgomery from the smaller engine were thrown onto the 600-degree overheated steam pipes and then against the firebox to be crushed by many tons of coal from the tender that crashed in on top of them. The firemen aboard the Camelback suffered the same fate. Surprisingly, all of the 337 people in the coaches' cars survived, and so did most of the 31 people in the parlor cars, but not all. Mrs. George Shuford of Biltmore, North Carolina, was trapped under the debris for 5 hours. She was finally pulled out when rescuers using blowtorches cut through the metal beams, trapping her, but she died in Southampton Hospital the next day. She'd remained awake for much of this ordeal. She was told repeatedly that her two children were alive, but they were not. She died not knowing. Her parents-in-law, Charles Angel, and his wife survived with only minor injuries. The, quote, Negro maid, unquote, survived but had to have a leg amputated. Harold Fish was thrown out of the parlor car, over the Camelback engine, and onto the floor of the pickle works, where he died from suffocation from the barrels of salt pouring down upon him. He had not been seen in time. The other occupants of the parlor car survived, either with or without injuries. It took 5 days to clear all the debris, and the pickle works did not survive. But that is the story of what was probably the biggest wreck of the LIRR 1926 in Suffolk County, and a story written in Dan's papers by Dan Ratner himself, August of 2016. What a story. There's a lot more of it. Go to danspapers.com to read the rest. But that's what you get from taking a train out east. You see a spur, you look it up, you have your maps app going, you do some research, and you get a story like you never would have believed that happened right there at that particular spot.
Incredible.
Imagine making pickles there. Never would have guessed.
No, never, ever.
Ireland's full of history. Just have to look for it. Okay, so getting back to the present day. You see this these comments came from the ambassador from the UK about Trump. Nasty, nasty words. Called Trump a very stupid guy. Oh, actually, no. That's Trump calling the ambassador a very stupid guy. The ambassador was basically calling it as he saw it and saying that this administration is out of control. I'm looking for the exact quotes. But it was a leak. It was not supposed to be seen by Trump, obviously. You heard about it, right?
Yes. I was looking for some indication of how it was actually leaked.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure that out myself. but, you know, like Theresa May says, and like a lot of the politicians over there are saying, this is his job. This is what he's supposed to be doing. He's supposed to be giving his impressions as to what is going on in the country that he is serving. And that's what he did. It was not something that he intended to have leaked, but it was. This is something I would imagine ambassadors from many different countries are also saying in various ways. And the fact that Trump has reacted so badly, well, it's not surprising. It's basically exactly what you would expect him to do. Okay, clumsy and inept was one of the phrases that was used by the ambassador. This is when you consider it's his defensiveness was one of the issues. He's reacting with more defensiveness and saying that he's not going to deal with the ambassador. What does that mean? Well, it's one of our closest allies. He's not going to deal with them anymore. He expects England to simply pick somebody that he likes. It's not how it works.
No, it isn't. No, it's unfortunate because they historically had. We've had the quote special relationship with the UK. So yeah, exactly how that works. I mean, this is again more evidence of distancing and abandoning of norms in so far as different diplomatic relationships that have been really namestays in our foreign policy, and now we're just going to abandon it and go our own way and so forth.
Meanwhile, our Governor Cuomo signed a bill yesterday that will allow congressional committees to access Trump's New York State tax returns, potentially giving Democrats a way around the White House's refusal to make available the president's federal returns. So, will the Democrats actually have the guts to do this? That's the question. Keep an eye on that. They have a pathway now. But you know, I'm so disillusioned with how timid they are. All they have to do is take advantage of this and see what's really going on, make it public. That's what we elected them to do. We talked about this in weeks past about undocumented immigrants being able to get driver's licenses. Well, it turns out at least one Western New York County clerk has filed a lawsuit challenging the legality of this new law that allows people in the country illegally to obtain driver's licenses. Michael Kearns, an Erie County Democrat, says the new law compels county clerks across the state to be an instrument to violate federal law. I don't know of any federal law that says that people who are immigrants to this country who aren't citizens aren't allowed to have driver's licenses. Show me that law. I don't know of a law that does that. The driver's license bill was approved in June, with the Democrat-led Assembly and Senate voting largely along party lines. Cuomo said he was concerned about whether federal immigration officials would be able to access drivers' information and use it for deportation purposes, raising the possibility of a veto. That is a valid concern, especially in light of some things that we've learned about in the last week, where the FBI has been doing exactly that. And ICE is also scanning driver's license photos to match with people that they're looking for. Very scary. Are we giving them the tools to do this? That is what Cuomo was concerned about, and rightly so. So it's getting it from all ends. Basically, conservative Democrats who want to kill this thing, and then you have other people criticizing Cuomo for being concerned. Steve Choi, executive director at NYIC, New York Immigration Coalition, says if Governor Cuomo wants to be the champion to immigrant New Yorkers that he claims to be, he needs to stop throwing cold water on a crucial legislative achievement that he signed into law. For months, we heard how the governor supports the law, and yet he and his staff have done everything they can to undermine it. Bit of an exaggeration there. He's expressing concern over people's privacy being violated and people being victimized because they are immigrants to this country and because they are undocumented, and being able to search for them through a database that we set up, that's something to be concerned about. He is rightfully concerned. Finally, the one thing I want to say about this is why? Why is this considered a big deal if somebody has a driver's license or not? There is nothing on the driver's license application that compels you to prove that you are a citizen. Nothing. And here's something else. Undocumented immigrants can get bank accounts. Did you know that? They are allowed to get bank accounts. To confirm an immigrant's name and birthday, banks typically require one of the following documents: an unexpired passport, a government-issued driver's license, including foreign licenses, an ID, a birth certificate. You don't have to be a citizen. Now, we are all bent out of shape over giving people in this country without documentation a driver's license. Shouldn't we be upset that they have bank accounts too? They're contributing to the economy? Should we be upset they're using credit cards? Should we be upset at everything they do in this country because of their immigration status? How is it relevant? That's a question we're not asking enough.
Yeah. No, it's this slippery slope that ends up being more and more invasive. And I think crippling, mm-hmm. right? Because you're getting at different aspects of life. Today it's, can you drive? Can you get to a job? Can you pick up your kids? Can you interact with the police if you're pulled over? And tomorrow it's, you can't save money. You have to walk around with cash. You can't deposit checks and you can't finance wire transfers or remittance.
Yeah, we are not ICE agents. We should not be acting as such. We should not be investigating every person to demand their citizenship papers. That is not who we are. Yet that is what people seem to be expecting. You should be able to drive a car legally. You should be able to use a bank. You should be able to use an ATM. You should be able to do all the things that people can do. And documentation, that is a whole different conversation with a whole different group of people. It is irrelevant to being a human being and interacting with other human beings. Unfortunately, we must stop interacting now because we are out of time. But I want to thank everybody for listening. Write to us, otw@2600.com. Good night.
Good night.
Beef is not what Jay said to Nas. Beef is when the working folks can't find jobs. So they trying to find niggas to rob. Trying to find bigger guns for them to finish the job. Beef is when the crack babies can't find moms. Cause they in a pine box. I lock behind bars. Beef ain't the summer jam for Hot 97. Beef is the cocaine and AIDS epidemic. Beef don't come with a radio edit. Beef is when the judge is calling you defendant. Beef, it come with a long jail sentence. Hand it down to you in a few short minutes.
Walking down the road with the beef still in the waist. Too young and too bad.
Almost deaf.
Walking down the road with the rich in the waist. Too young and too bad.
Beef is when your girl come through for a visit. Tell you how she pregnant, buy some of a nigga. Beef is high blood pressure and bad credit. Need a loan for your home, but you too broke to get it. And all your little kids doing is getting bigger. You trying not to raise them around these wild niggas. Beef is when a gold nigga got your seat in a manicure hand out like, pay me, nigga. Or I'm telling your wife for starting up some foul rumor that to ruin your life. Beef is when the gangster ain't doing it right. Another gangster's undecided what to do with his life.
Walking down the road with the pistol in your waist. Young, you're too bad. Walking down the road with the ratchet in your waist. Young, you're too bad.
Beef is not what these famous niggas do on the mic. Beef is what George Bush would do in a fight. Beef is Miss Wallace, still don't know who shot Biggie. And beef is well done, Irv not being here with me. When a soldier ends his life with his own gun, beef is trying to figure out what to tell his son. Beef is oil prices and geopolitics. Beef is Iraq, the West Bank, and Gaza Strip. Some beef is big and some beef is small. But charcoal beef is not beef at all. No, beef is real life happening every day. And it's realer than the songs that you gave to K-Slay.
This review cannot be kept.
President Trump appointed Mr. Acosta to some-